our next guest in the neighborhood today on Dave's Gone By. Really, really excited to have this writer, this author of all different genres and all different media, here in the neighborhood. He's written plays, including Scuba Dooba and Steam Bath, the very celebrated Steam Bath. And then he also has written novels like Stern and About Harry Towns and the somewhat controversially titled book The Dick, which is, yes, it's about a detective. Don't get your minds out of there. And also, he had a hand in the screenplays for such movies as The Lonely Guy, Stir Crazy, and Splash. All of this in the very long and fruitful career of our guest in the neighborhood, Bruce J. Friedman. First of all, Bruce, can you hear me?
Yeah, it's a little fuzzy, but I can kind of hear you.
All right, well, I guess that's probably just my terrible diction. I'll try to speak less fuzzily, because there's nothing I can do about the board or the actual quality otherwise. So I'll just enunciate better. How are you, Bruce J. Friedman?
Decent. Highly decent.
Highly decent. I heard you were doing only moderately decent a while ago, so it's better to hear that you're doing. Are you physically healthy? Are you good there?
Again, I'm having trouble. When we first spoke and I called you, I could hear you very clearly, but now something's going on.
I'm coming through the microphone through the board rather than talking to you on, a regular telephone receiver. So
we'll do the best we can, I guess.
So anyway, my question was, and I guess I'm also talking very quickly, but I'll talk a little slower as well, which may help. How are you physically?
I had a little setback with some knee replacement surgery that went slightly awry, but I'm hanging in. I'm doing well.
May I ask how old you are?
81. Didn't
Mazel
even hesitate. You know.
Mazel tov, mazel tov. 81. Yeah, you're entitled to a new knee. You really are. You should use
right.
it in good health. But here's the reason, one of the main reasons, aside from just wanting to talk to this man, the reason that we're specifically talking to Bruce J. Friedman now is that you have finally sent out your memoirs, your new book called Lucky Bruce. It's on Biblioasis Books, and it's the story of your work and your life. And I guess the first question always is, why now? Why the summing up at this particular point?
Why did I choose to write a memoir? Is that what you're asking?
Yeah, and why didn't you write it 10 years ago or maybe 10 years from now? Why now?
Oh, well, I do some speaking, not every 10 minutes, but some teaching and some speaking, and now and then someone would tap me on the shoulder and say, "My, you've had an interesting life. Why don't you write about it?" I hadn't thought of it as particularly fascinating, but others did. And I think mostly it was the what appealed to them was the wide compass. In other words, having some achievement in the novel and also in film and on the stage, which is a little bit unusual in our literary culture. There aren't too many. Woody Allen doesn't write novels, and Philip Roth doesn't write screenplays,
yeah.
And people stick to their last, what they're good at. And for some reason, I've been curious about each of these forms, and I never found it terribly intimidating to cross over, because to me, it was always storytelling in another form.
And do you elevate one above the other, or are they all equally valid to you? I mean, do you feel like, oh, I've just written another novel, as opposed to, oh, I tossed off a play, or is each one its own unique gem of a thing?
Well, no, it really is a matter of what what I want to write about,
mm-hmm.
And something feels like a short story. That's where I'm most comfortable, or more ambitiously, it might feel like a novel. and screenplays came my way because I'd get a call every now and then from, you know, from someone in Hollywood with a suggestion. And I'd follow through on that and had some success with that.
Well, I think the interesting thing is that you did have some films and screenplays that I guess you feel close to and that were basically yours. I assume The Lonely Guy was kind of like that, and maybe Stir Crazy, whereas your especially in the memoir, you say your experience on Splash was not so happy.
Yeah. Well, the result was, I suppose, a happy one, commercially. No, it got, you know, there were other fingerprints on it, and I would have been happier if there weren't, actually.
Well, can I ask, what did Babalu Mandel change about your script for Splash? I mean, you can't argue with success. It's a delightful film. It made millions of dollars. Probably did all right for your bank account. But how would the movie have been different if it had been Bruce J. Friedman's Splash?
Well, I'd set out to write a more pure romance. And I don't... Maybe I shouldn't use the word vulgarized, but I mean, it got more about a guy... I don't know what you're allowed to say on the radio.
It's college radio. We're okay. Well, I mean...
Oh, I mean, about a guy trying to get laid, you know?
Yeah,
and
you that. Yeah.
That's not what I set out to do. So that was one change. Also, I had my original character in the fish business, in the smoked fish business. I did a lot of research on smoked fish. It seemed to me if he was going to fall in love with a mermaid, that was a good occupation, so that got changed into the fruit and vegetable business. Because, quite frankly, you know, Hollywood has this nervousness about something that might sound a little Jewish.
No, really?
yeah, it still continues, I believe. It's absurd. But smoked fish somehow connoted, you know, it seemed to be a Jewish occupation.
And they changed the name, too, didn't they? It was going to be the lead character, the Tom Hanks character, had a more Jewy name when you wrote it, right?
Tell me again.
When you wrote the script, didn't the Tom Hanks character have a more Jewy...
Yeah, it had a different name. Yeah. I think Adam became Alan, or, you know, it's been a while now.
Oh, sure.
But that was another... you know, basically cosmetic change. But the sense of it, I guess, was on the screen, and they did some very good things.
Okay, so you're not unhappy about the whole experience, ultimately. I mean, it probably hurt a bit at first.
I had mixed feelings. For example, what attracted me initially was I'd written a book called The Lonely Guy, and someone, that's how it all began. Someone from United Artists said, what if one of your lonely guys fell in love with a mermaid?
Hmm.
And that's what I was given. It interested me because I was thinking about Poseidon and legends of the deep. And I like, even in a screenplay, I like to kind of learn something or do a little research. Oh, it's I like every project to be completely different. I never was the kind of fella to come up with a single detective and do 15 different variations of it. I would have gotten bored.
Hmm.
So that's a determining factor with me. Is it completely different? But Poseidon and Legends of the Deep and the Poseidon Kingdom never got shown on the screen, although it was in my script. And that was pre-digital. I think that might have been one reason it was bypassed. Or maybe they just didn't feel it was necessary.
Yeah. And we should say also that The Lonely Guy ended up becoming a movie on its own. It was a Steve Martin film that, you know. So how did you get to sort of have more control over that one?
Well, control is an odd word when you couple it with screenwriting. you know, I once was complaining to Richard Pryor about some mistreatment by the studios on a film I was working, and he listened patiently, and at the end he said, "Did you get paid?" And finally, the whole idea, if you want control, you do what some of these people do now in the lower budget area. You you know, you learn the camera and you make the movie and you control it. You know, you do what Woody Allen does. I was never really that interested in making movies. I tried it. The whole Hollywood experience was more was fun. The only thing I disliked about it was the actual work. When I was asked to come off the tennis court and to write a few pages, I was always a little offended, actually. So Hollywood, to me, represented fun. I never took it seriously. Huh. I like the movies now a lot more now that I'm not working on them.
Well, okay, you can step away and look back at them. I didn't, unfortunately, have a chance to read the whole book. I only had time to skim it because I just got it. But when you wrote that novel, Stern, you thought it was going to be a disaster? Am I misquoting that?
Which film are we talking
about? No, I'm talking about your book, your novel, Stern.
Oh, yes, I did. It was a first novel, and I was really frightened and thinking seriously about leaving the country.
Good Lord.
Because it was so, you know, close to the bone. And it was on a touchy subject, and I didn't know how it was going to be received. But I was wrong, and it had a glowing reception, especially from the from the more serious critics, which is what I wanted.
Well, sure.
So I got away with that.
What was that, before or after Portnoy?
It was the before.
Timeline. It was before, but so
it was a few. Yeah, it was. Yeah. I mean, I was aware of Philip Roth and his absolutely wonderful stories in the New Yorker. But Stern came first, and very often comparisons are made, but at least chronologically, I was there, whatever there means, first.
And so that book really kind of launched, I think, your literary career. And have there been other times, like you mentioned, there was another book that you wrote that just did not get the...
Can you repeat that? I'm having increasing difficulty hearing you.
And, you know, I just have to get closer to the microphone. I think that will help also. But there's a book called About Harry Towns.
Yes.
I think you mentioned in another interview you really like a lot, but that one just didn't seem to click with the critics. I mean, how do you get through that?
Well, I got the Harry Towns part, but I didn't really get the question.
Oh, I just meant unlike Stern, which was pretty much universally acclaimed, and you know, you have other books that maybe did not get so well received. How do you put your heart and soul into these other books, send your babies out there, and then, you know, you deal with the backlash if there is one?
Well, I'll try to piece together asking me. I don't know what's going on with the sound, but yes, you get surprised, you know, as to what's going to work, and I never think very much about the audience. Very selfish of me, but if the material interests me, that's where I go. And this whole, you know, there are two kinds of writing. There are people who wonder what how a book will be received, how many people are going to read it, whatever, and it becomes sort of like the shoe business. What shoes are people going to prefer next year? And I simply followed the material, whatever really interests me, right up to today. And that's where I go, and it's only secondary. I mean, it's fun when when the readership or the audience goes along and has the same set of concerns that I do.
And one of the things I heard you mention in another interview also is this idea of going back and revising and rewriting some stuff. Like you were going to do a sequel to Stern, and then you were thinking of kind of looking back at that. Are you still planning some revisions on things as well as new books and things to write?
Again, I'm having that same difficulty here. Things to write.
Well, in other words, the stuff that you're working on now, which I thought you mentioned included not only new things, but maybe going back and revising and looking at other pieces like Stir and Kings.
What am I doing right now? I'm still enjoying the glow, frankly, of this nice experience I had with the memoir and the reviews that I got. I haven't had that kind of reception from the Times, which is the one you want, particularly the Daily Times, sort of a love letter. So I'm coming down a little bit from that. But whenever I have a so-called interim period, I write short stories. So that's what I'm doing, and I have enough for what would turn out to be a sixth collection of stories that have been published but haven't been collected yet.
Oh, wow.
And I have, and there are, there's actually a sequel I did to, sort of a sequel I did to Stern, where I pick him up 30 years later. And that is a work in progress, something I'll, the fates permitting, which I'll go back to.
Cool. Let's also remind people that your current memoir is called Lucky Bruce. It's on Biblioasis Books. And let's get to some of the cool stories that everybody would want to hear about and read about. I guess the one that was really the tempest in the teapot is your famous fist fight, not really, with Norman Mailer. Would you mind explaining how you ended up fighting, sort of, with Norman Mailer?
Well, from the very first, when I met Norman, I sensed, I don't know if it was my ego, that he was sort of glaring at me, and someone explained that I reminded him of someone who used to beat him mercilessly at tennis at Harvard. And I looked like that guy, And as far as the fight, that was an embarrassment. No way I could avoid it. But Norman, I had a play that was it was a pretty big hit at the time. It's called Scuba Duba. And Norman had a play called Deer Park, which was really struggling to just stay afloat. And he had always dreamed of having a big play. He envied Arthur Miller and dreamed of having that big play on Broadway with Marilyn Monroe thrown into the mix. The evening had a kind of undercurrent of violence at a party I was invited to, and I just started to leave. There's only one way out, and there he was sort of blocking it. And I wasn't innocent entirely, because I remember rumpling his hair a little, and Norman, it's really time for us to go. And that got him all upset, and next thing I know, his wife of the time, Beverly, was shouting, "Kill the bastard, Norman." And we both dutifully went outside in the street and had what passed for a fight. But it was, writers aren't very good at fighting, although they're fascinated by it. I doubt that Hemingway was much good for all of his bluster.
Uh-huh.
But I think Norman was even worse at it than I was. So, but during this semi-fight, I remember him calling out Scuba Dooba, the name of my play. Scuba Dooba sucks. So apparently it was really bothering him. And a mutual friend told me he took Norman to see my play, and at the end of it, Norman pounded on the armrest and said, "I know what it is. Friedman's a wit." I mean, as if I'd pulled some underhanded trick, you know. Norman, as so many writers are, worried, concerned that they're not funny. I don't know why it should bother them. Mario Puzo, at the height of his fame, and he was a close friend, every once in a while he'd look off in the distance. He was the highest paid writer in history. Look off in the distance and say, how come they never call me for comedy? So it's sort of a pressure point with writers. They're worried that they're not funny enough. And I think Norman
He was not really known for laughs.
I thought he was quite witty in his way. I don't know if I've answered your question.
Well, no. That is the story. I mean, you go
now
into
I can
more,
hardly hear you at all.
You go into more detail in the book about that story and a bunch of other stories. But how did you and Mario Puzo become best buddies?
Oh, well, through the late 50s, early 60s, I was editor of a group of men's adventure magazines called Male Men, True Action, and Man's World, four of them. And I had an opening on the staff. Two people came up. One was Arthur Kretschmer, who went on to become editor of Playboy for many decades. And the other was Mario. And what I really needed was a writer, someone who could help fill up that quota. I had to buy like 70 stories a month. So as bright as Arthur was, Mario was a writer, I could tell. This is pre-Godfather. And the story that always goes along with that, and it's irresistible to me, is in 1963 he approached me and said, I was his editor at the magazines, and said he was working on a novel and he'd like to try out the title on me. I'm thinking of calling it The Godfather. What do you think?
Yeah.
And I said, well, not much, frankly. Mario, it sounds a little domestic to me. I would take another shot at it. And, so he gave me a look of steel, a look that you really wouldn't. It's a short, stout man, but you would not want to see that look again. And the odd thing about it is I probably was right, for it would have been the wrong title on any other book but The Godfather. It was a little domestic, but until you found out what The Godfather meant. But but we became friends right to the end. I guess he died, well, more than a decade ago, and rarely a day passes that I don't think of him.
Oh, wow.
And one of his observations, or one of his remarks, absolutely wonderful man.
And one of the things I'm also curious about, by the way, can you hear me a little better now? By any chance?
A little better.
Oh, good. Okay. Is a story about you being part of this group of writers, pretty famous and successful writers, and you wouldn't really want to let another writer in because he was too good. Was that a true story there?
Oh, sure. I do remember that. We had a lunch out in Southampton, Long Island. It was Puzo when he was at the height of his fame, and Joseph Heller and Heller's friend Speed Vogel, and Mel Brooks would join us when he was there. And every once in a while, we'd think about somebody else who might want to join us for lunch. And I proposed Jim Salter, brilliant guy, a terrific guy. And Mario vetoed him by saying, no, he's too good a writer.
And what did he mean by that? Did it just mean you would feel inadequate there, or that he would be brought down to a lower level by being with you guys? What did he mean?
What did he mean by
it?
Well, I think Jim is quite brilliant, but he's sort of a special taste, if you know his work.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of like having a taste for some very, very fine wine. Which is, and the taste is lost on somebody like me, who's very happy with a $10 bottle of wine. You know,
I'm happy with two
so
buck chuck.
It was,
yeah.
It was somewhat in that area.
Cool. We are, by the way, talking with Bruce J. Friedman, and wanted to ask a few other things. I did not realize also that the movie, the Elaine May movie, The Heartbreak Kid, was based on a short story of yours. Is that true?
Yes. It was first published in Esquire magazine under the title Change of Plan, and there was immediate film interest in it, which happens once in a blue moon. And it ended up being The Heartbreak Kid, the first version, which was written, the screenplay was written by Neil Simon.
Oh.
And Elaine May directed it.
Mm-hmm.
And it was my favorite experience. And it was, you know, based on my short story. And in many ways, it was my favorite experience in Hollywood because I didn't have to do anything. I just bought some popcorn and went to see the movie. And I thought it was, I really liked it a lot. And I liked, I watched the sequel, which I didn't care for as much. I thought the first 20 minutes or so were kind of funny, and then it, in my view, it sort of went off a cliff.
Do you mean the sequel or the remake?
The remake.
Remake, okay, cool.
Sequel's
yeah.
Interesting, because I do, I did have a sequel in mind.
Oh.
Who knows? I might even, maybe we'll even make that. But I did have a sequel in mind.
I'm kind
picking
of
up that character 20 years later, you know.
I'm kind of curious. Did your experience in the Air Force inform your writing or your worldview in any way?
Oh, I don't know about the worldview. I'm not sure I have one now. But in a way, it led to my introduction to the literary world. I had one experience that really shook me up in the during a flight, and I was terribly upset by it. It was a near death, and didn't know quite what to do about it. So I wrote a short story, the first one I tried, and I sent it off to the New Yorker, which, if you can imagine such a thing, had even more prominence at that time than it does now. It's still a wonderful magazine. And then I forgot about it and got a call or a letter from the fiction editor, Hollis Alpert, who said, this isn't quite right for us, but do you have anything else? Well, I didn't have anything else. I was 23, so I sat down in my mother's kitchen, and I wrote another story called Wonderful Golden Rule Days, totally unrelated to my Air Force experience, and they bought that. So there I was, a published writer at a very early age, and that one story led to another story, led to another one, and then the progression is you then move on and try a novel. And the rest is at least my own private history.
Well, at what point were you able to get out of the publishing of men's adventure magazines and rely solely on writing?
it was a big step for me because my income was good. I was 35 years old. But I was sending people around the country and even abroad, places that I wanted to go to.
Mm-hmm.
So it took me about a year to make, because I had a family. I had a wife and three children.
Wow.
And a very good income at the time. And it took me about a year to make up my mind that I just had enough of that. And I wanted to just try my wings as a writer, you know, an everyday writer. And so finally I just quit. And then it took me about 10 minutes to get used to it. A year to get ready to make that leap and 10 minutes to get used to it. And I never really looked back, except for the water cooler stuff, you know, the social aspect of it, that you'd be around people during the day. So I miss that a little bit, but in a funny way, the theater, working in the theater, takes care of that. It's a, you know, there's a lot of social interaction, and the girls are prettier.
If they're really girls, yeah. No, that's well. No, speaking of pretty girls, actually, that has to do with it's a weird segue, but the first time that I even noticed or heard of Bruce J. Friedman was when Steam Bath premiered on PBS TV. I mean, I was a kid. I don't remember what year that was, but it was the early 70s. So, you know, I was barely a teenager at that point. And so, you know, I kind of liked artsy and cultural things, and I liked watching Channel 13 a lot in New York. So I'm like, oh, let me watch this play, and it's interesting, and you know, I recognize Bill Bixby from My Little Martian. And then suddenly Valerie Perrine walks into the shower room, and I was like, okay, I'm not gay. that was like the moment. I was like, okay, I like that. I like those. And then I tried to pay attention to the rest of the play, but the idea for Steam Bath, that, you know, of a men's room attendant being, I mean, how did that come to you?
At the time, I was spending some time in a steam bath on Lexington Avenue during my lunch period at the magazines. I'd go over and work out and take a steam bath, and people, well, they exposed themselves verbally in a steam bath and have a way of talking to each other, and you get an interesting collection of characters. Add on that there was a kind of Puerto Rican influx at the time in Manhattan, a certain Puerto Rican style, verbal style. Plus, I'd had a bad experience at a Chinese restaurant where I thought, you know, it was like an intensive care kind of situation.
Wow.
So scrambled them all together, and you have... you know, a fella who's just been ill or come from a Chinese restaurant and wanders into this steam bath and is told that the towel attendant is God. And most of the first act is taken up with proving his divinity. That's how all of that happened.
Huh. And were you worried about that show too, or did you realize maybe with that one that it was controversial enough and funny enough that it would be, audiences would receive it pretty well? It would be something of a cause célèbre.
I thought once it got on, I thought it would. It was, after all, it was following Scooby-Doo, which had been a real major hit at the time. Everybody wanted to direct the play, and we wound up with Anthony Perkins, who not only directed it, but at the last minute jumped in and played the leading role.
Well, you tell some wonderful stories in your memoir, Lucky Bruce, about the decision leading up to not only getting Anthony Perkins to direct, but him kind of saying no to a bunch of other actors, possibly because he had it in mind to be in it from the very first. I mean, you're not sure, but you kind of feel like, you know, he may have had that in the back of his mind.
Well, I was still more or less a rookie and naive in the way of the theater, and we had at least three or four beyond competent, but really terrific actors. Well, one would include Dick Shawn. He was really too frightened to really play the lead. But we had some very good actors, and somehow Tony found them, for one reason or another, insufficient. It never occurred to me that he had always wanted to play that part. So at the end, when I think it was Rip Torn, didn't quite work out, Tony very graciously agreed to play the lead, and he played it impeccably, actually. It was he's a very good actor, very, very smart guy, and I was very fond of him.
And this was also, like, towards the very beginning of the career of the guy who played the janitor, was Hector Elizondo, right?
Yeah. Cool. We had interviewed about, 40 or 50 Hispanic actors, and I began to feel that I'd written a very poor part. And then Elizondo showed up. He had a bad bronchial infection. You could hardly hear him speak above a whisper. Perkins got very impatient with him, and Elizondo left the theater where we were auditioning, and I said, Tony, we've got to use this guy, because Perkins was upset because he was mumbling. And I said, well, look, I listened to those mumbles. They were great mumbles, and he's going to be just fine. So we hired him.
Actually, you tell
him. He's gone on to,
of course,
have, you know, quite a nice career.
No, he's a brilliant, brilliant actor. And although you do tell one little awful story, I don't, forgive me if I'm forgetting the name. Was it Dana Andrews who?
Oh, you mean, Dana Andrews came up and auditioned for the lead, and gave, to me, the best reading of anything I'd written ever. I was really overcome by it. Like, it was a magnificent reading. It made the work 10 times better than it really was. So he came back to chat, and as far as I was concerned, there's no question he would get that part.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, oh, by the way, who's directing the play? So I said, Anthony Perkins. Sorry for laughing.
Sure.
He said, that faggot? You expect me to be directed by that faggot? And he went storming out of the theater, and we never saw him again.
Was he homophobic, or did he have a specific hatred of Anthony Perkins?
Homophobic, I think, is putting it mildly.
But it could also be the thing of, like, he hated Perkins specifically and just used that word in a way to tar Perkins.
We'll never know. I mean, he may have had some, it never occurred to me. He may have had some personal reason related to a Hollywood experience having nothing to do with the gay side.
Right.
But I just quoted him directly.
Wow. That's a nasty little story right there. But obviously Steam Bath turned out very, very well. And so have you written, when was the last time you wrote a play?
Well, wrote a play. I wrote a play recently.
Ooh.
that I'm still working on. But the last fully produced play I had, which worked out very well, was about 12 years ago, roughly. It was called Have You Spoken to Any Jews Lately? And it was performed at the American Jewish Theater.
Oh.
And very well reviewed, although the run was limited. And it's had a couple of other productions. It's a tricky production. But what's it about? Two men, friends, in some remote part of the country. It could have been the tip of Eastern Long Island, a place like that, who slowly realize over the course of the first act that they are the last two Jews left in the country and probably in the world. And that's the and then it's how it plays out and how they deal with it. Again, very well received, but didn't have as much of a future as I would have wanted.
I always wonder about that. I mean, if you have like a success in a small theater, I mean, the American Jewish Theater doesn't even exist anymore. I think
that's true.
Upright Citizens Brigade took over their theater a few years ago after it went dark, and then the Jewish Rep is gone up on 90s. I mean, you know, now Jewish theater is just inculcated into regular theater. But I do wonder why, you know, you have something and you figure, okay, here it's poised. And there's got to be some producer ready to take it to a bigger level, to a, you know, a major off-Broadway venue or a big Broadway house. How come, I don't know, how do you deal when it just doesn't happen, you know?
Well, a lot, I mean, I don't know if it's worth getting into, but there were two, it was a very edgy, to put it mildly, play to begin with. There were two producers. One was crazy about it, and he said, we've been looking for an angry play, and this is the one we want to do. And the other producer was sort of quiet and lukewarm. So the angry guy, the fellow who was all enthusiastic, died suddenly. And we were left with the guy who was unenthusiastic and mostly concerned about his subscription audience, which was mostly Holocaust survivors.
Oh, God.
I mean, they wanted to see Milk and Honey.
Right.
And would have been happy to see it over and over. And here I am, you know, with this very dark play. I thought it was, you know, it was funny, I hope, but dark. And so even when the play opened and got a rave review in the Times, he still was upset because he said his subscription people were tearing up their tickets and throwing them in his face. So there was no – what you needed was a strong producer at the helm.
Yeah.
He was just happy when the play, you know, closed, was it 6 or 7 weeks. So there it is. It was picked up, done a few times, but I didn't think very successfully.
And I guess this is the lesson of all this, is no matter what, you turn to the next thing, because you don't know how something is going to be received, and you don't know, you know, even when it's well-received, you don't know if it'll jump to another level or just sit there like an egg and splat. So you just have to go back to the typewriter, or I assume you work on a computer now.
You assume correctly.
Okay. You never know. Sometimes, I mean, Arthur Miller wrote longhand on a legal pad, I think, for all of his life. Even
well, it took me a while. And also, you have to look at those stories carefully. There's one novelist I know who's very proud of having nothing to do with a computer. He writes on those big yellow legal pads.
Mm-hmm.
But when you look into it, you find out that when he's finished working with the legal pads, he hands them over to his wife to put on the computer.
And she does it on her iPad, and she's running it through Twitter. And yeah, well, who did I interview once? Not on the radio, but for and it was Joan. Who's not Joan Collins, the actress? Who's her sister, the writer? But. You know, she'll just write a bit and dictate, and then all goes off to her secretary to really polish it up, and then she goes through and makes the corrections. So, but, okay, oh, what is her name? She writes tons of romance novels. Sister of Joan Collins. Bestseller. Oh, well.
I can't quite help on this.
Yeah, it's okay, yeah. I mean, I know the name.
I know the play you're talking about.
The person, yeah. Anyway, I did not realize until also looking up your autobiography that you're the father of caricaturist Drew Friedman. I didn't realize that. So he's had quite a bit of success in his field as well.
Oh, well, he's a phenomenon. I mean, I just don't know where that comes from.
Okay.
He can keep 20 people busy. I mean, he's he's that good and that much in demand, and he's extraordinary. Again, I don't know. I can't draw a picture of a highway sign. His mother had some ability, as I recall, but she didn't really do very much with it. Hmm. But Drew, from time he was 3 years old and could pick up a crayon, you could tell that he had, you know, had ability. And he just amazes me. And the other part of it, he also happens to be a very, very nice guy.
Well, good. I hope you can say that about all your kids.
I can't say enough about him, yeah.
Right. No, and I hope you have three children, which I imagine, you know, that affected your career early on because you were afraid to leave the job that you had. But then, you know, how was it being a dad and then also trying to be a full-time writer, entertainment, filmmaking person, having to go a lot of different places? Did it conflict or did you balance it?
Well, early on, there was some pressure on me. You know, I was in my 20s. And I had three boys, and I had barely been introduced to my wife. That's the way it was back there in the 50s. You know, people got married often for the wrong reasons. So there I was with three young boys and a wife and a mortgage. And I had to really scramble to, in fact, I named my company, which I had for a while, Scrambler.
Hmm.
But we've always been very close. You know, we had an early divorce, and I've never been further away from them than, you know, a five minute ride or a phone call. We're a very, very tight family, and that would include Molly, my daughter, who's now 27. With the second wife.
Actually, are we talking about Molly M. from A Literary Light?
Molly K.
Molly. Oh, different Molly. Okay, because someone named Molly was the PR person for the book.
No, different.
Molly. Okay, just checking. Cool. Well, I mean, and it's great, of course, that you've got the new family, and of course, the second marriage has lasted how long?
Oh, it's been perfection.
Mazel tov, mazel tov. Yeah. When, what year are you going on in marriage number two?
Oh, easy 30 years.
Mazel
I'm
again?
I'm not good at keeping track of this precisely, but it's been a good 30 years and a very good 30 years.
Well, it's been a very, very good time talking with Bruce J. Friedman, the author, the playwright, the novelist, the screenwriter, and, of course, the memoirist of Lucky Bruce, available from Oasis Books, is it? Yeah, Biblioasis, excuse me, Books. Lucky Bruce. Last question for the Lucky Bruce that we are talking to, because you've had a pretty lucky career overall. And I guess the question now is, especially at your advancing age, when you're not working on all these things that you're trying to get out in you know, hopefully the last 10, 20 years that you've got, what are you doing for fun, for hobbies?
I'm not much of a hobbyist. I mean, I get asked about retiring, and I wouldn't know what to do with myself, actually, other than write my next story. I was, pretty much, I was involved in outdoor stuff up until recently. I did a lot of biking, played a lot of tennis. But now it's reading and watching movies and scribbling every day, you know, and my family.
Is that
and
the thing?
That's about it. I mean, stamp collecting doesn't interest me.
Does it interest anyone anymore? I don't know. You know, 10-year-olds. Can I ask though? Is that your routine? You have to write. You set aside a block of time every morning. Is that your ritual?
Well, it's not necessarily every morning, but at some point in the day, I pick it up, and even if it's just a matter of worrying about it, I'm always in touch with it. I always have a. Have to have a. a project, or I'm not really a project, meaning a story I'm writing,
mm-hmm.
or a play I'm working on, or I'm really not fit to live with.
I sort of know that feeling somehow. I don't know why. Well, I hope that you are working on many projects, be they Stern Kills or another play or another novel or whatever you turn your attentions to. I do want to thank you so much for being with us in the neighborhood. It's just been a fabulous time chatting with you.
Well, I enjoyed it, and thank you.
Thank you so much, Bruce J. Friedman. Bye-bye now.
Bye now.